Welcome back to Anesthesia on Air, the podcast from Royal College of Anaesthetists. My name is Dr. Owen Dorr. I'm the Digital Education Content Fellow at the college. I'm also an ST7 anaesthetist working in Thames Valley. Today, we're going to visit the incredibly important topic of wellbeing at work with two experts on the subject that we're very lucky to have. Firstly, I'm joined by Neil Greenberg, a Professor of Defence Mental Health at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience at King's College. He's also President of the Society of Occupational Medicine, a Consultant Occupation and Forensic Psychologist, and a former Royal Marine Green Beret. He's published over 400 papers and is considered an expert and original author in TRIM. So very lucky to have you today, Neil.
Good day.
I'm also joined by Dr. Ramai Santhapala, a fellow UCL graduate and now consultant anaesthetist at Guy's and St. Thomas's. She's the wellbeing lead for the RCOA Council and an advocate and lead for wellbeing and its importance for patient care. And is also a recently qualified yoga teacher, amongst many other things. Welcome, Ramai.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for joining us today. Wellbeing is top of the agenda for many people, and we're very lucky to have this podcast out at the moment when we've just had the RCOA workforce reports come out, which has shown that wellbeing for anaesthetists is lower than the general population, with over half of those answering the survey showing that they had moderate burnout, with extreme burnout symptoms in about 6% of people. And it's keyly linked to our stress at work, along with our last-minute sickness leave. What's off with you, Ramai? What is wellbeing?
So there are many definitions. And as I've mentioned when I've spoken to this before, often head to ChatGPT, primarily because I think it encompasses all the components of well-being. And it says it's the overall state of healthy and happy contentment in various aspects of life, and it encompasses both physical, mental well-being, as well as one's kind of social connections and emotional well-being as well. So I like the fact that this is multifaceted. I think where it perhaps falls down is it very much speaks to the individual's responsibility for their own personal well-being. And whilst that's true to some small degree within healthcare, I think we know that a lot of the solutions to well-being lie within the systemic factors, which we'll go on to discuss in this podcast. So I like the fact that it's really holistic, but we do have to remember that it's not down to the individual solely within the workplace.
Neil, following on from that, why is it important? Why does it matter?
So I think it's worth thinking about well-being along a spectrum. So yeah, most of us get on with our day-to-day life. We don't really dwell on how good we're feeling or how bad we're feeling unless it reaches some level of particular importance. And so the reason why it's important is when your well-being is not as you need it to be, that's when it causes problems. And, you know, if your well-being stays in a poor state, then that actually can lead to you developing a formal mental health problem like depression or an anxiety disorder. And so it's inevitable, I think, in the world we live in, particularly in healthcare, that with the stresses that go on, that you're going to have periods where your well-being is not as ideal as you like it. And so being able to monitor and be aware of your well-being, and importantly, the well-being of your colleagues and your team, means that you can stop people becoming unwell and try and, as I always describe it, push them back into the green zone of being generally okay and getting on with life. There is, of course, the other side, the more positive side of well-being, where, you know, when you go on your holidays, when you interact with your family and your friends, you actually do that and it brings you a sense of excitement and enjoyment. And life isn't all about avoiding being unwell. You know, we live, hopefully, not just to work, but and to try and get to a state of well-being and enjoyment and, dare I even say, happiness. And so that's where we want to be getting towards, rather than thinking about it always being on the negative side.
And with your Society of Occupational Medicine hat on, what does that involve? And why is occupational health so important to us as anaesthetists?
Well, the Society of Occupational Medicine has been around for 90 years now. We had our 90th anniversary last year. And I'm pleased to say I'm the first psychiatrist to be the president. So that's quite a privilege. We're a multidisciplinary organisation comprising of people who are interested in occupational health. Most of them are clinicians, many doctors and nurses, physiotherapists, occupational therapists and the like. And what we're really interested in is trying to advocate for people being able to be at work and be healthy at work. And the reason that we do that isn't just it's good for the organisation, so it's good for the NHS, obviously, to have healthy staff members who are effective, but it's also good for the individual. And over the years, if you look at how occupational medicine has evolved, you know, the years ago, there were factories full of horrible dusts and toxic compounds. And that's where the focus was, in trying to create physical safety so that people's physical health stayed good. I think we've realized over the last 30 years that actually mental stressors are also a form of toxicity, a different form of toxicity, I agree. And so really we need to do more to make sure that workplaces are psychologically healthy, because that creates a much better outcome. In this case, you know, we want good patient care. That's why the health service exists. And if we want to have good patient outcomes, we need to have healthy staff working.
And leading on from that, what interventions have you seen that have been in the workplace that have supported good working health in terms of a culture or policies?
So just like I mentioned early on, I think it's really important to think not just about this at the individual level. It's important to think about it at the group level, the team, and also the organisational level. We have the system in which you work. And so in very broad terms, adopting a preventative medicine approach, the best thing you can do is protect staff so that they don't become unwell in the first place. The next best thing is obviously to detect early signs that people have got problems and get them fixed. The last bit, the tertiary prevention, is finding people who unfortunately are unwell and getting them back to good health. So I think we need to spend more time investing in things that we know are likely to protect people from becoming unwell in the first place. And the evidence on that is pretty good. The World Health Organization have a mental health at work guidance document, which if you can't sleep is a very effective way of getting you off to sleep because it's very, very thick. But it's got a huge amount of evidence in there. And if you synthesize that down to simple messages, the most important intervention in a workplace setting to improve mental health is training up junior supervisors how to have a psychologically focused conversation. So if you think about people in the workplace, often it's the sort of the senior managers who go on these communication courses, and that's great. But it's the people who are the first level of supervisors who need to know how to identify who might have a problem and have a, you know, psychologically focused chat and see what's going on. Of all the things that you might do, and there's lots of things, that's the most impactful intervention that you could do. So translating that into healthcare, we need to make sure that everybody who is a leader of any sort, you know, right from the most junior level, has some training about how to have a psychologically focused conversation, because that makes a really substantial difference.
Is there too early a time in someone's training pathway to start them on these conversations? Or do you think that starting from day one at foundation or even medical school would be useful as well?
I fully believe it should start straight away. I think these are useful skills for healthcare professionals to have anyway, because you have to communicate with our patients to find out information. So if we can put that into a package that doesn't just help us deliver better patient care directly, but also helps us better communicate with our colleagues and support them, then everybody wins. And I think the real danger is, much as I like online learning, some of these things need practical skills assessment. Now, I'm a psychiatrist, not an anaesthetist, but I imagine that the skills that you have, you can't just do an online training package to teach you some of those techniques. You have to practice them. And communication skills are exactly the same. So when we train people how to have psychologically focused conversations, you have to have a bit where you practice having those conversations so that you can develop the skills and, importantly, the confidence to have those discussions.
And bring us on to actually anaesthetics. When we're talking about kind of workplace culture, how do you think, Ramai, a department can develop a good workplace culture and look after its anaesthetists?
So I think Neil touched upon two important factors. There's the physical needs of making sure you've got the right equipment, you've got the right access to drugs, for example. But actually, I think the biggest aspect is creating psychological safety. And that starts with the clinical leadership and infiltrates downwards. We know the emotional contagion, you know, how the leader acts is how the team generally acts as well. I really echo Neil's comments about training in having those psychologically sensitive conversations and being able to detect early when someone's well-being is probably not as optimal as we'd hope. And we have to remember that anaesthetics is particularly unique. We are a high-stakes specialty, and I think even for a low-risk patient, things can go wrong. So actually, you know, we're constantly trying to deliver high quality care irrespective of the patient in front of us. So I think strong kind of leadership skills, strong facilitation skills, skills around having those conversations and creating psychological safety. I'm also a very big fan of peer-to-peer support. And I think we're really unique as a specialty with respect to sometimes some of the scenarios that we see. I've spoken to this prior, you know, I have a non-medical family, and I think if I tried to explain some of the things that we see as anaesthetists, it'd be quite alarming almost. So I think it's really important as peers to look after each other, and it'd be really good to hear from Neil actually what some of those early warning signs might be that a colleague might not be performing to their optimal aspects. I think I just wanted to add one other aspect, and it's something that I've been reflecting on quite recently. Is I've been thinking about moral injury for well over a decade, obviously in the other guys kind of supporting shared decision-making work. But I think it's really good to have a self-awareness of where you sit when things do go wrong, and you know how you do process that at an individual level, and knowing what coping mechanisms, healthy coping mechanisms you have to try and support that, because I think we're all quite different there.
It'd be great to have a definition of what moral injury is. And again, a bit similar to well-being, although there will be overlaps. Why is it important? Why should we be thinking about it when we are at the, I don't want to say the front line of healthcare, but sometimes it definitely feels like that.
Yeah, well, I've said my personal point of view. I think you are at the front line of healthcare much of the time. So moral injury are the strong negative reactions we get when we're exposed to an event which clashes with our moral or ethical code. So being put in a situation where you're asked to do something or you have to do something which doesn't sit with your sense of what's right and wrong. And actually, it's great here chatting to you, because one of the descriptions I often use to try and describe this when I'm talking about it to audiences is an intensive care nurse. You know, who, you know, might deal with one patient very, very well. And if that patient unfortunately dies, at least they know they gave them the best care. But during COVID, as we all know, sometimes that nurse had four patients to deal with and there were two or three alarms going off. And, you know, what do you do? Where's the right alarm to go and attend to? And what we call a potentially morally injurious event, which is PMIE, it's a horribly long, complex name. But it's often an event where people say, it should never have happened. I should never have been put in that position. And that's, of course, right. People shouldn't have been. But, of course, life gets in the way. And so often we find ourselves in a situation where perhaps we don't have the right resources, or we don't have enough staff, or something's happened that's unexpected that someone else should have picked up. And that leaves us having to act in a way which strongly clashes with what we believe should have happened. And those moral ambiguities can lead to what we call moral injury, of strong feelings of disgust, shame, guilt, or anger. Moral injury is not an illness. It's not like depression or post-traumatic stress disorder, but it's definitely a vulnerability. And what we know from big studies we've done at King's College London on lots of healthcare staff, many thousands of healthcare staff, is that people who report high levels of moral injury are much more likely to develop depression, to develop post-traumatic stress disorder, or sadly to exhibit suicidality as well. So whilst it's not an illness, it's a really important topic. And I think in healthcare, because we often have strong beliefs that drive us to try and deliver good care, we are at the same time more vulnerable to suffer with moral injury, because things don't always work out as they should.
No, unfortunately, don't always get the outcome you want, especially sometimes when you are in some hospitals, you're thinking about the different level of care that someone might receive in another one. That can be very difficult to handle. Is there a good way to recognise it in ourselves or others, and the best way to address it?
Yep. So moral injury kind of occurs, like most mental health issues, along a spectrum. And the best way that you can spot that someone's mentally in a poor place, that their mental well-being has been affected, moral injury or potential mental health or mental well-being problem, is to think about it in the kind of four factors in terms of their emotions, their thoughts, their behaviours, and also their somatic, their symptoms. And so we all know that when you're stressed, you're far more likely to, you know, your back's hurting more, you get more headaches, you feel a bit more sick. So the physical symptoms. So someone who's normally physically healthy complaining of things that they don't normally, you know, that's one of the combat indicators. Someone who's much more negative than they normally were, you know, the person who's the life and soul of the party being much more quiet, or the person who's being irritable and shouty when they're not. So what you're really looking for is a change in someone's normal patterns of the way they are. And at that point, of course, you don't know what the cause of that is. Not unless you can see into their mind, which certainly a psychiatrist we got. And so the real thing there, we go back to that psychologically savvy conversation, is that the right thing is, you know, I've noticed that you're more irritable. I've noticed that you are not your usual social self. Can I ask what's up? And just by asking that initial question, you know, taking what you've seen, saying it sensitively and asking what's up gives people an opportunity to, you know, to tell you what's going on. And of course, it doesn't always work. Some people just say, I'm fine, because they don't want to have those conversations. And at that point, if you've done the right training and you're psychologically a little bit more aware, then actually you can then start to kind of gently probe. You can't force someone to tell you, but you can create an opportunity where if they're going to tell anybody, it might well be you. So really what you're looking for changes, and then what you're going to do with that is to use that to ask them a question about how they're doing.
Just bringing it back to our anaesthetic context, I think it's also the timing of those conversations. Perhaps, you know, in the middle of a busy clinical day, your colleague's more likely to say, no, I'm fine. But maybe, you know, waiting until they've about to go to the changing rooms, you know, to change at the end of the day is probably a good time to catch them and say, just exactly say that, you know, very calmly, objectively measured, you know, I've noticed these. In a very non-accusatory manner, you know, is everything okay? And that's a perfect time to grab a cup of tea or something and just start to kind of unpack what might be going on with your colleague under the surface. So I think the timing is really key.
Yeah, I think the unique place we are in anaesthetics, well, one of the interesting and I found quite distressing parts of the RCOA workforce report was that only 33% of people were actually regularly going to, off to have lunch breaks and or have time to eat or drink. And you're thinking that is the time of which they would be able to go and seek an area of psychological safety during a busy list if something hadn't gone right, or if they were suffering from something the day before. We're not giving our staff, colleagues or teams the time to be able to decompress and seek out these peer networks. In terms of the in terms of anaesthetists, is there ways that departments can support these peer support networks more, do you think, Ramai?
So I think the success of Coffee and Gas is really pertinent. So this is essentially having protected time. And I think it's important that it's for all categories of doctors. So obviously it was originated for resident doctors, but I think SAS doctors, consultants, we all need it. So having that open forum where you can decompress is really important. There's obvious practical aspects such as rest facilities. So in our most recent AXA reports, we know that actually there's only 4% of hospitals that AXA accredited that didn't meet the rest facilities marker. So it's really great to see an improvement in that. So those practical aspects. I also think it's important because I think a lot of us try to decompress in exactly like you said, in the coffee room, 10 minutes between your patients, or if you do have, you know, the opportunity for a lunch break or a short break, but that perhaps isn't as effective as going to a separate place, maybe within the department. And I know that different hospitals will have different facilities for that, but just having something that's partially removed from the area that might be the cause of the wellbeing issue, is important. I know there's varied opinions and data and evidence on this, but I'm definitely a proponent of structured debriefs, particularly after traumatic events. But I think, you know, fundamentally, it's about looking after each other and just knowing that we work in a unique environment. And I know certainly, you know, from personal experience, but also the experiences of colleagues, it's those small acts of kindness that go a very long way. Just to give an example, I think I may have mentioned this before, you know, when I had a cardiovascular collapse, anaphylaxis, unexpected, it was a small act of kindness of the ITU colleague that I had at Guy's and St Thomas's after the event that made a huge difference. And I'll still remember that to this day. So I think it's showing compassionate leadership, showing that empathy and understanding, yes, we all go through these scenarios and it's in some way expected within the specialty that we speak to. But at the end of the day, we're all humans as well.
Are there any key warning signs that you think would be there, Neil, for burnout and when we should be asking people to think about getting extra help?
Yeah, so I mean, the evidence is pretty strong, actually. So I mentioned that the most impactful thing you can do is to train up junior supervisors. The next most important thing is to have a peer network, hopefully with some training, you know, who know what to spot and how to identify people who've got problems. There's actually quite a lot that a peer can do if they've got the time to try and provide support in the first instance. You don't need to jump straight to, you need to go and see a, you know, the mental health professional. So I think actually having someone be able to listen to what's going on, sometimes a simple problem-solving approach can really help. There's a great adage is that people in crisis problem solve badly. So often when you're, you know, you're stuck in this, I don't understand, and well, I can't see why this has happened, a colleague who gives you a damn good listening to actually could say, oh, it strikes me that this might help. And you might go, oh, I hadn't thought of that. So, you know, there's some simple practical stuff. If you can solve an issue, that's really good. However, if that's not going to work, then of course you as the peer needs to think, do I need to meet with them again? We've got to think about patient safety and the individual safety.
Of course, yeah.
And actually, do I also need to think about, you know, facilitating them onto someone who is more expert in mental health than me? So the peer's got to kind of make that kind of assessment. But often we don't need to rush to medical interventions for dealing with, you know, distress and initial well-being problems. And often having people listen to you and actually share the fact that actually you're not alone. I know it sounds a bit cheesy, but it's true. That can make a big difference. And I think one of the important things, actually, we've talked about this and touched on this a bit, is about this topic of psychological safety. And that is, much of that is set by the leadership. So actually, if the senior consultants are coming out saying that was a tough one, you know, and actually they're expressing that it's okay to talk about these things, that again sets the culture for what other people might do. And so I think that's a really important aspect of leadership, is to encourage people to share difficulties, because that can very much diffuse what's going on. There's a bit about this, you had this term to do with moral injury, about developing what we call a meaningful narrative. So a story in which it's not all my fault, it's not all the boss's fault, it's that we're in a difficult situation and healthcare is challenging at times, and actually we're doing the best we can in these difficult circumstances. So if you can develop that sense of we're in it together, that can often make a really big difference, and I think leadership has a big part to play in that.
Some of the departments that I've enjoyed and felt like I've thrived the most have been ones that have supported us through very difficult times.
I was wondering these sort of sessions whether actually we've all got shares in coffee and tea companies, which is why we talk about having cups of tea and coffee. You know? We're trying to promote Nescafe and our shares go up.
Well, I just, do you know what it is? I think it's just such a simple intervention. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of those aspects. I mean, you have it in a lot of leadership, isn't it? It's if you're going to have a difficult conversation, you know, just take that person for a coffee. It's just the simplest intervention. And I think it just extends to well-being, doesn't it? It kind of diffuses the formality of any meeting.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I've got onto a 5-a-day coffee habit, and I've realised that it's actually because that's like an excuse to go and get a refresh and take a walk. And maybe I should try and find some other ways to do that at the moment.
Peppermint tea.
Yeah, exactly.
So just leading on from that, Neil, that you can have a big impact in terms of negative well-being on your health, but it can also affect your work as well. Because you've mentioned on previous talks about presenteeism. What is that, and what is the link between well-being and our patient care?
So there's really strong evidence between someone's ability to perform their job effectively and their mental health. So we know that people who have got PTSD, for instance, we've done studies on people who get PTSD from military service, that somewhere between 3 and 10 times functional impairment happens. So people who have PTSD might function at, you know, 10% of their ability, particularly their cognitive ability. And, you know, as healthcare professionals, we know we are paid to use our brains. So we know that mental health problems substantially impair someone's ability to do their job well. And that's often termed presenteeism, which is sort of being at work in body, but not being there in mind or spirit. And of course, if we want to deliver high quality care, that it therefore follows that you need staff who have a good state of mental ill health. Without sort of going too much onto soapboxes, you know, the NHS has a part of it called NHS Resolution that pays out money for when, unfortunately, things don't go right. And that pays out £3 billion per year, which is an awful lot of money. Mm. And therefore, some of that, no doubt, is going to be because staff are not able to perform their job well because their mental health's not good. So I think that there is definitely savings in terms of protecting patients' health if we make sure that our staff's mental health is as good as it can be.
There'll be some people listening to this thinking, well, it's all very well and good you suggesting that I get a near peer to speak to me, but I'm not even having breaks. So what do you say to people about how we should be meeting basic human needs during their shifts?
Well, I think many of us will have heard of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is this concept that, you know, that there are high level needs such as feeling, having self-esteem and what's called self-actualization. But right at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy are physical needs. You know, so if we have a situation where people can't have breaks, where there's not enough staff, where they can't park their car near the place that they work, you know, if everything physically is incredibly difficult, we need to concentrate on getting those things right before we start thinking about how do we improve mental well-being. Because you can't make someone mentally healthy if actually their physical needs aren't at least met to some degree. And I think it's one of the jobs of senior leaders within healthcare to advocate for the team and to with managers to say, you know, I accept things aren't going to be perfect because we don't live in a perfect world. But if we don't get A, B and C right, we just can't expect our staff to be performing to a good level. And that's unfortunately going to impact upon our patient outcomes.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of lessons from the pandemic, and I was very lucky to work with two colleagues from the American Society of Anesthesiologists during the pandemic. So just to say, the ASA set up the Wellbeing Board in 2019, so very close to the pandemic, actually. So really good to learn from their lessons, especially as we evolved through probably one of the toughest times for our specialties. It was just really simple interventions. So still to this day, I believe that UCSF in San Francisco, they still do semi-regular burnout inventory, so not as extensive as the burnout inventories that we sometimes use here, but just to get, you know, essentially a touch point as to where everyone is, but also just have simple qualitative mechanisms to feed back what is bothering anesthesiologists within the department. And they've worked out it seems like simple interventions, but obviously logistically, you know, can be quite challenging. But it's just things like being able to get groceries after you finished a 3-session day. And I think we really learned from the pandemic that it's probably from, you know, Maslow's requirements that actually our basic needs were met to some degree, albeit that actually what we were experiencing every day was much tougher than perhaps most of us had in our careers. That, you know, that really makes a difference, not having to think about your rest facilities or where you're going to get hot food from, actually makes such a difference in terms of presenteeism and being able to just focus on what you need to get done clinically for the patient in front of you.
Neil, you've supported teams through a lot of major incidences, and I was just wondering what our listeners can learn from about how to prepare or lead teams following some of these major incidences that we have to deal with. So just moving on to it, why is traumatic stress important?
So it's important because in safety critical roles, and anaesthetics is definitely one of those, you are unfortunately going to experience traumatic events from time to time. And those events we know have a potential to create a lot of distress, which is quite normal for a few days, a few weeks, maybe even a few months. But also it will lead some people to become unwell, to develop conditions such as post-traumatic stress disorder or depression or similar sort of things, substance misuse. And why is that important? Well, it's important because if people are distressed and we manage them well and we look after them, A, they get better, and B, they also feel more loyal to the people who have helped them. And we need staff to stay in the NHS and to do a good job. So we need to look after them properly so that they will carry on sticking at their job. That's one thing. But we also need to prevent people becoming formally unwell, because those people perform badly, they create a lot of difficulties for others at work, at home, and eventually they're also more likely to separate from service, they're more likely to leave. And if you end up having to treat them and give them 8, 10, 12, 15 sessions, that's going to cost money, and also means that it's time they're not at work. So everybody loses if an individual in the healthcare service becomes unwell. The individual loses, but so do their colleagues and the service as a whole. So the better that we can prepare people to deal with trauma, and the better that we can support people in those first few days and weeks afterwards, the more likely it is that people will recover and they won't become unwell, and then they'll go on and hopefully have a successful career. So it is really important, because you can't avoid traumatic stress unless you just don't come to work, which isn't very helpful, really.
Is there a right way or a wrong way to lead some of these debriefs?
So there is a potential here, and it's just a potential, that if you start to get too psychologically focused, which maybe given your speciality, you're not likely to, but if you start to go down the line and say, we must bring in a psychiatrist or a psychologist who will talk to us about how terrible it all was and all those nasty emotions, that form of what we used to call psychological focus debriefing, that actually can make you worse. So the NICE guidelines on the management of PTSD say do not do psychologically focused debriefing. But what is very helpful is to do an operational type debrief. You know, so you as the team leader talking to your team and saying, gosh, that was tough, and then giving everybody an opportunity to say their take on it. So you don't force people to talk, but you give everybody, you know, you go around the room and give everyone a chance to speak. That allows everyone to get an understanding of what went on and to realize that actually you're in it together and it's not just one person who might have a difficulty. And that's also important at that time, that that's a no time that you don't do critiquing. So it may well be that you need to speak with members of the team because things might not have gone right, but you don't do that in the aftermath. So that after action review or that team hot debrief or whatever you might call it, is everyone gets a chance to speak. You're trying to develop a story or a narrative where everyone has some understanding of what went on. You're in it together. And anything more serious, you know, what went right, what went wrong, you deal with that later on.
Often we are leading teams sometimes with people who've never seen adverse outcomes before. And I remember one Christmas, someone thinking that a 5-minute delay in sending for the patient results in the bad outcome, which it hadn't. And they were in absolute bits about it. But having that debrief afterwards and narrative allowed us to address that and find extra support from them.
I think it's really important to instill a no-blame culture. And I think we can all do that as individual clinicians. And I think these incidents are often opportunities to look at the systems around it and how we can improve that. And I think it is really important to steer very clear of individual blame. I mean, there's always perhaps nuances that can be improved, but they're usually opportunities for trying to look at the wider kind of factors, you know, around just kind of operational pressures or the setup or the context that led to that incident, whether it's expected or not. So I know I'm a big proponent of, you know, lifting it to the systems level. And as Neil says, you know, if there is individual feedback that you do need to give it, that's done sensitively in a manner that's helpful and constructive for that particular individual, because it might be very impactful. And I'm not saying that any of us are immune to these events, but particularly when you start off in anaesthesia, I think it's really important that you handle those circumstances well. And I think, you know, a good parallel is, I don't do pediatric practice anymore, but, you know, I certainly remember from training in it, it was like, you know, that child's first anaesthetic should go, or hopefully goes as smoothly as possible, just in case they do need to come back to it. And I think it's that same parallel that particularly, you know, for someone starting off in anaesthesia in particular, that process is handled really sensitively and really well. So then that, you know, they're likely to meet these events again and actually know that there is light at the end of the tunnel on the other side of these events, and hopefully in a very constructive way of kind of dismantling what could have gone better at much more systems level.
Are there any tools or upskills that you would suggest for those who would wish for maybe a structure when it comes to these debriefs, or a way to maybe improve their debriefing skills?
So I think going back to what we talked about earlier on about having communication skills to be able to talk about psychological health in more broad terms is a useful for this, but also for lots of other reasons. One of the studies we actually did during COVID is we designed it was a 1-hour training, because you remember everyone was very busy, which basically was a little bit of a, you know, here's how you do it, here's a demonstration, and then getting people practicing. Now, we now do that over 2 hours, and we call it REACT, which is recognize, engage, actively listen, check for risk, talk about a specific plan. And this is used in some areas of the NHS as a tool to help supervisors feel confident to have these conversations. There are lots of other ways. I don't have a particular structure. I know there are that at Bath have the team at Bath have developed a hot debrief tool, and I've seen over my time interacting with lots of anaesthetic teams that actually people have different ones. I don't think there's a perfect tool, but I think if you keep the idea that it gives everyone a chance to talk and it's no critiquing, and what you're trying to do as the supervisor or the leader is you're trying to craft a message coming out that we're in this together and that, you know, we did our best. And that's your challenge, isn't it? By, oh, so I hear what I hear you saying is, and you're drawing that out. And then as we said, you know, anything else you need to do, you do later on. I think it's fine. But I think where some of the more senior people you mentioned about, you sort of feeling like an imposter is if you haven't had a chance to practice this and you're doing it for the first time for real, then it does feel really frightening, which goes back to that idea is that if you practice those skills a few times in the classroom, then that can make a really positive difference.
Just in terms of a take home, it'd be great to have a take home message about people who are struggling with burnout or worried about colleagues who are struggling with burnout.
So I think one of the things I would say is that if you feel that your own well-being has been affected, and if it's been going on for a while and it's not getting better, you know, that's the indicator that you need to do something different. And I would start off by trying to think, what is it about yourself? What is it about what's going on with you that's not right? And what things can you change that actually make a practical change that actually might impact upon your sense of well-being? And that might be people you talk to, you know, people you trust. It might be changes you can make to the way that you work. It might be re-engaging with, you know, things that you used to do, but you stopped doing, then these things that used to bring you enjoyment. So I definitely think that from yourself is don't just think I'm stuck in it. Try and think about ways and things that you can change, including talking to people you trust. I think in terms of supporting colleagues, I think we've already discussed that the most important thing is when you spot something's potentially not right is to ask that question, you know, what's up? How are things going? But I think before you do that, also think about yourself. You know, if you're in a really difficult place and you've got financial issues, work's a pest, you've got sick kids and you've got health problems, do think, am I in the right place at this time to help my colleague? And if you're not, then I wouldn't start on by taking someone else's difficulties on to your own. I would absolutely go and try and encourage them to speak to somebody else or maybe mention it to another colleague who might be better off. But don't just think about wading in and saving everyone else, you know, before you think about, am I in the right place to do this?
As a final thought as well, Ramai, when we're talking about wellbeing with your RCOA Council wellbeing hat on, what can we do to support peer networks more within anaesthesia? And is there anything that you would want to signpost people to as kind of wellbeing resources?
So I think with respect to peer-to-peer support, I think there's different levels of it. But obviously, coffee and gas has an evidence base behind it. And I know many departments who have protected times for resident doctors. And I know that's sometimes challenging for departments, but I also think it's incredibly useful. I mean, you can speak to your own experiences, Owen, perhaps of that as a resident yourself. But I do also think that we need to be cognizant that all groups of doctors, so the recent consensus obviously highlighted locally employed doctors as particularly vulnerable, but all categories of doctors, or, you know, within anaesthesia, pain medicine, intensive care and perioperative care need that same level of peer support, because actually the circumstances that you go through, whether it's clinical outcomes or, you know, leadership challenges, are very similar. So I think it's about thinking how we create that in different spheres. And obviously the more senior you are, the more difficult that can be logistically to find that time. But I think it's important. We have got the RCOA Wellbeing Hub, which has a series of resources from, you know, those that need semi-emergent or emergent support on an individual level through to aspects such as the anxiety that naturally comes with exams and other life events. So definitely would like to signpost the Wellbeing Hub. And I think the last thing to say, and we've mentioned it, is, you know, how contemporaneous this podcast is to the wellbeing, burnout and retention consensus, and really urge at least clinical leaderships within departments to read that and really take some of those messages home and see if there are practical steps that can come out of that.
Thank you so much for coming in today. It's been a fantastic episode and I've really enjoyed our conversation. So thank you, Neil.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Ramai, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks very much.
And thank you for listening. We'll have lots of information on the blurb for you to have a look, along with previous wellbeing podcasts and useful links, including the RCOA Workforce Census. And for more podcasts like this, make sure you subscribe to Anaesthesia on Air and review us whilst you're there.